enjoying that a great deal.
In the 50 years that I have been at ECU, wanting for a long time to write about the experience of leading a study abroad program, something that I happened upon when I first got here and I stayed with, and it's been probably the most important aspect of my career, the thing that will stick with me the most, that's had the most impact on students. And I've never found a pretext or a frame or an excuse to get started. So maybe I have finally found a pretext to begin this project. I'm going to be referring frequently to two texts that I teach in London, which a lot of you might be familiar with. Sam Selvam's The Lonely Londoners, which was written in the year of my birth, 1956. And concerns immigration to London of folks from Trinidad and also from Jamaica and some other places after World War II. And Andrea Levy's Small Island is much more recent, 2004, a younger writer, but writing about also the experience of Jamaicans, mostly, who came to the mother country, a phrase that you see frequently in notebooks, for patriotic reasons, to serve in the war, and then they were rather shocked by the treatment that they received and their relatives received when they came to join them in England after World War II. So that's a bit of a frame. Two of the aspects that I connect with most powerfully, emotionally, in Lonely Londoners, the newcomers coming to Waterloo Station, which is their gateway, their entry point, and having no experience of London or England other than this hazy fantasy notion of what this place must be like, and only this phrase, the mother country, and everything that goes with that phrase, this place that will be nurturing, that is somehow a part of me, a part of where I belong, or whatever. Similarly, in this story, Hortense comes from Jamaica, well-educated, capable, brave, comes to London to join her husband, and he doesn't show up at the dock. She's there by herself and has to make her way to Earl's Court, where he's found a crappy little hole in the wall for them to live, but he's sort of forgotten to show up at the dock. So it's that experience of landing someplace new and terrifying and foreign in spite of our notions that inspired me. Let me read you a piece that I've written, and then I would like you to tell me what you'd like to hear more about, where I can expand this and develop it. We come by plane rather than by boat, but we're a motley-looking group, leaning against a railing at the coach park area of Gatwick Airport. One of the group, unbeknownst to me, is a native of the Dominican Republic. Sadly enough, this part is absolutely true and still gives me the shivers. One of our group, unbeknownst to me, is a native of the Dominican Republic, though a permanent resident of the United States. Somehow she had passed through every checkpoint at the university and all of its bureaucratic processes, and even with the airline, and made it to the point of London immigration where this little detail was discovered. If one is from the Dominican Republic, one needs a visa to enter the United Kingdom. It took a bureaucratic miracle, if one can believe in such things, to get her special permission to enter the United Kingdom without a visa for our 3-week study abroad program. A torrent of tears and such persuasive powers as I could muster. Both of our tears. along with a remarkably compassionate immigration official, effected this unforgettable, if still slightly traumatic, entry into the country. Our emergence from this harrowing process and reunion with the rest of the group, having passed through immigration, waiting for our coach ride to central London, produced a raucous ovation, met by the locals and other travelers with a great deal of embarrassment. But we had passed muster with the UK border agency and could begin our three-week adventure. After a sleepless overnight plane ride, all of us feel and look a bit bedraggled. There are 24 of us, most having never traveled out of the country, some having never left their own regions of the United States. Although all of the students had been warned about culture shock. It's England. What culture shock? It's the same as the United States. They are unprepared for the strangeness of the landscape, the damp chill in the June air, the illegible billboards, and traffic on the wrong side of the road. In each suitcase are copies of Sam Selvone's book, The Lonely Londoners, and Andrew Levy's Small Island. To prepare for this experience, they have read authors such as Zadie Smith, a lot of you have read White Teeth probably, Bucci Amichetta, Monica Ali, Elif Shafak, and Xiaolu Guo, representing a small portion of the stunning cultural variety they will witness and experience in London. They will consider imaginatively what it means to be an immigrant, what that perplexing theoretical term transnational means. They have struggled with the remoteness of these texts and their peculiar idioms, particularly this one's very difficult to read, I would say. But now they are on a coach, not a bus, driving on the left, heading for the Marble Arch area of Hyde Park and central London. A few of them have found Marble Arch on Google Earth, and if they've read ahead, they've noted that it was an important social location for the characters in Selvone's novel when they did something called coasting lime on a Saturday night. For the first time, many of them are beginning to experience what it means to be, quote, foreign. And they will read and understand these texts differently from now on. I fancy myself as Selvone's Moses, their living body makeup, welcoming these exhausted, culture-shocked, and literally alienated students to a place which is stunningly diverse and difficult to navigate. It's a place where their national origin suddenly signifies something quite different from what they've ever experienced. For our African-American students, it's a place where their skin color suddenly means something different. One of the most moving passages in The Lonely Londoners is the character Galahad's apostrophe to blackness. And Galahad watched the color of his hand and talked to it, saying, "Color, is you causing all this, you know? Why the hell can't you be blue or red or green if you can't be white?" It is clear very quickly to our African-American students that their skin color is read differently here. And parsing that difference for many of them is a bit unnerving, but also certainly consciousness raising. Who am I here? Andrea Levy in Small Island also offers a sharp contrast between the manifestations of racial prejudice experienced in America and the form experienced in the UK. Perhaps the difference is in the level of familiarity between the U.S. and the U.K., the U.S. version. I know who you are and I don't like you, as opposed to the somewhat more muted British version. I'm curious about who you are, but I probably won't like you when I find out. Ladies Gilbert has come from Jamaica to serve both the mother country in World War II. His position as airman assigned to motor transport puts him at the bottom of the military hierarchy, and he's essentially a gopher. we see the intersection of British and American military cultures when American soldiers refuse to deliver needed hardware to their British counterparts. Gilbert, who's assigned the task of driving to the American base, it's really a kind of hazing that he's been given this assignment, hears his associates, his British associates, refer to the, quote, bloody Yanks, arrogant sods, belligerent blighters. And then he is greeted by the Americans by racial anger and a string of epithets. The American sergeant complains, quote, he, the British CO, sent that black just to piss me off. Fucking whinies. 70 years on, even in a transmogrified landscape, there remains something of this old distinction that I think may inform the way our African-American students are received, and our white students as well. Our white students are, perhaps to their surprise, not somehow instantly accepted and assimilated by virtue of their privileged whiteness. They must discover that their Americanness is as apparent as their skin color. Even when they are silent, the accent, of course, is telltale. Uncanny as it seems, they're almost instantly recognized by dress, demeanor, gait, that aggregation of traits and habits that somehow comprise Homo Americanus. They see that glint of recognition in the cashier's eye and in his smirk as he slowly and carefully counts out change in the student's palms. i.e., you're a stupid American. We are othered, status uncertain, suspect, resented. For our gingers, I learned that term a couple of years ago, you know what that means? For our gingers, there is an extra level of othering. Red hair suddenly takes on a different cultural significance. All the various markers of identity, many of which they've been completely unaware of, are reconsidered, reinterpreted. They're aliens. Obviously, they are not as poor as Selvin's fellers, although many have begged, borrowed, and stolen to participate in this program. And they are temporary immigrants with the knowledge that the comforts and relative safety of home await in less than a month. But for most of our students, 3 weeks is a long time to be genuinely away for the first time. The younger ones, especially, come to the experience malleable, impressionable, subject to cultural influence to a surprising degree, and they leave changed. As self-appointed Moses, part of my duty is to help them navigate their inevitable disillusionment as they face the difference between the dream London of Hail Britannia and Big Ben and the Tower Bridge, and the real 21st century city. Perhaps the first disillusion that they've discovered in their reading is the distinctive racism faced by immigrants to the city. The Jamaicans denied housing and enduring incredible hardships in Small Island. The Trinidadians and others of Selvon's multi-ethnic band eking out their survival at the bottom of the class structure. This London they're seeing for the first time through coach windows as endless rows of shops stream by, is self-evidently a remarkably diverse place. And yet they have learned already, when they Googled the words London and multicultural, it is also the center of a violent backlash against multiculturalism and a virulent xenophobia that somehow coexists with all the visible celebrations of London's many ethnic identities. The students stow their bags in our rather Spartan flats. These are a far cry from the room Gilbert finds for himself and his newly arrived Jamaican wife Hortense in Earl's Court, a room rented to them by the shockingly unconventional Queen, a white character, who violates neighborhood decorum and unwritten law by renting to, quote, darkies. Selvin's character, Cap, also has incidentally found a room in Earl's Court, a district west of central London that has hosted a succession of different immigrant groups, as well as serving as the principal locale for the gay and lesbian community before being supplanted by Soho. In subtle ways, students can relate to Queenie's shock at the cold, gloomy weather, and her drastically uninviting quarters as the students try to figure out how to flush the toilet and wonder whether the hot water will return in the morning or whether the elevator will be repaired. Still, they are a lot less inconvenienced than Hortense was in 1948, tasked by her husband to somehow make enough sense of a hot plate, sink, and basin to produce something called chips. She was a rather dramatic failure at producing a respectable chip, but I suppose she caught on to it eventually. Before the students have had a chance to crash from their long, sleepless night in the plane, I become Selvon's Moses once more, rousing them from the flats and into the city, where they must purchase underground tickets and subject their aching bodies to a grueling geography lesson. For Selvon's characters, and for Hortense, and for almost all the protagonists of these novels relating the experience of London immigration, to learn the tube is a kind of freedom, a survival strategy. Without that knowledge, without some basic understanding of the underground grid, one risks becoming terribly, if not irretrievably, lost. Learning the tube is a step toward independence, toward discovering the magic of popping up in an escalator and entering a different new world at every tube stop, an ethnic carnival of unimaginable variety. A few years ago, we had one student somewhat defiantly take off on the tube before understanding the system. He had a long and very frightening day. And when he returned, I sang to him a song that came from an A.A. Milne poem called James, James, Morrison, Morrison. I don't know any of you know the poem, but it warns about the dangers of, quote, going to the end of the town by oneself. That was the last time he got lost. For the characters in The Lonely Londoners, the underground is a place of employment, one of the few places that will hire, quote, the fellers, who are given, of course, the most dreadful tasks to perform. But it's also a vital part of their social connection, their mobility, their avenue to connect with each other and to coastline on a Saturday night. For me, on that first day, it's a strategy to defeat jet lag, to keep the students awake and moving until the early evening hours when they can finally crash. In their fatigue, they're vulnerable, still carrying the smell of travel and useless American coins. All is bewilderingly unfamiliar until they emerge from the Westminster tube stop, look up, and immediately in front of them is that icon of all kinds, icons, the clock tower. That's my little tube trick, my little tube magic. And there it is, and you have to go like this to take a picture of it. There's Big Ben. And some of them, in spite of themselves, get a bit watery-eyed. This place, never any stranger's warm, welcoming mother, nevertheless retains for many of us a mystic hold. Location, location, location. Believe it or not, it took me many years to begin to understand the connection between where we were and what we were reading in London. In the early years, my curriculum included a packaged literary London volume of the type divided by districts or neighborhoods, with canned tour guide accounts of who was who, or perhaps who merited the ubiquitous blue plaques that you see on the houses designated someone famous, maybe someone worthy of being included in the Dictionary of National Biography. Not surprisingly, these handbooks are completely monocultural, a guide to the British literary canon. Then we'd read a bit of Dickens to accompany a visit to the Dickens house, some Defoe before a trip to the Barbican neighborhood where the author of Moll Flanders lived, some Samuel Johnson before visiting the great Cham's house on Gough Square, and we'd read whatever Shakespeare was being produced by the reconstructed Globe, which seemed like a godsend when it was finished in my fourth year of running the program in 1993, although some scholars referred to it contemptuously as the winemaker Globe, with its taint of vulgar American wealth, as Americans are good for something. For £5, my students can approximate the experience of being a groundling, thrillingly close to the stage and almost literally absorbed in the theatrical action, at least until their legs start to ache in the fourth act. It's the aching legs that is one of the keys to me to what this experience means and how it's so vitally important as a part of students' education and so different from the conventional classroom where one's legs never ache. As the years passed, I never lost my love for the tube, that sense of complete novelty waiting at each new stop along the line. Increasingly, though, what struck me about the neighborhoods was not the exciting activities that would be available in the different boroughs and districts. What struck me was the ethnic diversity represented by each shop, by each stop, the restaurants and shops, the people dressed in very un-British riots of color and texture. I wanted to find the literature that reflected this London. And that's part of my own transformation that you talked about. A literature that emerged dramatically amid conflict and partial reconciliation from the Thatcher years to the present, the span of my own stint as temporary immigrant and self-appointed Moses. Quote, he and Cap uses to coast Bayswater Road from the arch to the gate nearly every night. What in the world does that mean? In the traditional classroom, that decontextualized space, it means very little. But now we are in Hyde Park, sitting in a circle in the shadow of Marble Arch, talking about Selwyn's Marble Arch, the Marble Arch of the Fellers. In the air there are frisbees, no, discs. And a homeless person nearby turns on his side. A retriever suddenly dashes past, and there is heavy pram traffic on the sidewalk. We close our eyes and we slip back a half century with ease, where Cap and Moses and the women to whom they say bonsoir, walking to Notting Hill Gate and the lazy incline of Portobello Road. There is a kind of alchemy made possible by dislocation or relocation that does not happen in the classroom back home. It's the exhilarating juxtaposition of past and present that is everywhere in London, the beautiful array of people and cultures that lets us all coast line. Now, what does coasting line mean? This is a pretty good research project. Google it. It's clearly something important in the book. I'm now quoting a student. I get this question all the time when students read this for the first time. It's clearly something important in the book, but I searched the term and found nothing. I had a similar experience when I first read this book, and it's lovely but puzzling idiom, a combination of beat poetry, Anglo-Caribbean argot, and literary modernism. There's mention of the phrase in one critical piece that I found, Linda Pilier's The Voice of the Foreigner, Reproducing Caribbean English in the Postcolonial Novel, 2006, but she doesn't define the term. And the student's instinct was valid. It's a centrally important phrase and concept in the novel, a moment of bliss for those who experience, an attitude that comes from freedom and brotherly love, a defiant expression of joy. It's a kind of hanging out, but with the notion of expectant pleasure and the mysteries of the evening hours. For these Trinidadians and Jamaicans, it's a kind of epiphanic link for their characters to home and past, a fusion of memory and the excitement of the moment. I realize that's not a terribly functional definition, but I hope it suggests the idea that coasting line is something that all of us aliens can experience, whether exiled by choice or by poverty or by dream or some imagined ideal. Even in this modernist hell, this cold racist nightmare that brings its characters to a terrible moment of existential crisis. Color, is this you that's causing all this? There is love and youth and hope. For these immigrants, the power of hosting mine transforms Marble Arch from a cold emblem of British imperialism to a totemic symbol of masculine sexuality, of brotherhood. It hints at the fact that these young men, with an incredibly tenuous toehold in a mostly cruel and unwelcoming landscape, will survive and thrive. Marble Arch is still there, and so are the fellers. And so now are we. And we will toast them with our bottled water and rocket and prawn sandwiches from the Pret a Manger, and we will coastline. What I want to get at further is more about pedagogy, more trying to explain and develop what I felt about the uniqueness and the importance of this. It's a constant thorn in my side that it's been so expensive. I fought to try to make it cheap and to develop sources of funding and scholarships and so on. But it's expensive, and that's a negative aspect of all study abroad programs, really. But it's a transforming experience, and I want the ones least likely to go. That's always my recruiting goal. Get the ones who need it the most. And once they're there, they'll find a way to pay for it. They'll find a way to survive and make the most of it. And, you know, to those students, I've tried to commit myself.
I like the way you put over the concept in terms of your students being in London. Have you ever talked, though, of students or individuals coming from another country, and what are they view when they touch down in America? You know, you had a good view of your transformation and the things that went on. And I think a lot of it is within your head.
Yeah.
And when you got there, it was nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I would be interested to hear about when, because foreigners have something in their head about America.
Right.
And I would be interested to hear when they touched down, how do they view now America?
My own experience is so limited. My beloved, as you know, came from Malaysia and wasn't here such a long time when we met and fell in love a few years ago. but through her and through that connection, I heard the stories anyway from an awful lot of Chinese folks, or ethnic Chinese folks coming to America, but I have a very, very limited experience with that and would like to hear more and learn more.
Rick, may I add something here? May I add something here?
Please.
We have to speak up in business. In the English department, we do not get a whole lot of students who come from other places. But we've had one or two, we've had a number of them from Belize.
That's what's so wonderful about our Belizean students.
Any Belizean in here, put your hand up, please. That's our latest goal there. But the few that we've had bring such an enriching experience, and it's such a shock. One, coming to America, but two coming to Greenville. But I think Jeff, Eastern teacher may I ask, right? Yeah. Jeff, Lucy, and I don't know if anybody else I'm missing here, do teach in a multidisciplinary program called the MAIS program, Masters of Arts in International Studies. And we get a number of students from foreign countries. Some of them would come in. Last semester, I had a Chinese student who just touched down, and he thought he knew about African Americans. And he decided to present on Martin Luther Jr. King, King Jr. I have a dream speech. And you should have heard the teaching moments of that God. So I met him in the hallway yesterday, and I was asking him, what are you going to do after your master? You're going to do a PhD now? I want to go to New York City and work. And he started to imitate Robert De Niro and the Italian New Yorker, and he was pretty good. He said, you see, I will get a job in New York City. But it's a fascinating experience each one can bring to, from abroad.
But you know what I like? I'm sorry to do something different, but you know, it's what I like about the presentation, how like your students would feel how the characters feel. You know, that's
right.
The part I like
right.
about it.
And it's so hard. I mean, the business of teaching multicultural literature, it seems to me, is at least beginning the process of feeling what other folks feel. Or seeing through their eyes. I mean, you only can ever approximate. But this is a step in that direction.
You know, another question I have. You know that sometimes American people, I mean, not everybody, right? But sometimes they have this attitude of superiority. But I have met some Americans that would say, they don't even want to know anything about other countries, and they think it in their heads that they're the best in the world. You know, like they even have an attitude. You know, like, oh, we're the best. You know, like, what do we need to know about England? So, Italy. You know, so my question is, like, do they change this attitude? Some of your students, like, when they go to England, I mean, if they have this attitude before they go, like, do they change it?
Yes, and it's remarkable to see them change in the 3 weeks that they're there. And part of the reason that they change is that they're so frightened at the beginning. And from that sense of displacement and fear comes the kind of malleability that I was talking about. They make friends in the pubs and start to talk to people, and they hear about the typical attitudes. Americans are loud, they're obnoxious, and they know-it-all and all those other things that Americans are supposed to be. They hear all that, and they
I think that's enriching. It's so enriching for the student, like personally, in terms of literature. And I think it's a wonderful experience.
It's dwarfed for me anything else I've been able to do.
I have, I guess, a couple of questions. You said you wanted to know where you thought you should write more.
Right.
And I understand that this is part of something that you're going to continue to work on, something
yes.
like a larger
yes.
piece. Okay. So I was looking for, or, you know, really liking the connections that you made between the text and the experience of the students, which I thought was like a really interesting combination of memoir and criticism, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked what you were talking about with the older curriculum you started with when you first did the program.
Right.
With like Shakespeare and some Dickens and things like that, and I got the feeling that your curriculum changed, like as you had done it more times.
Right.
And so I was wondering if you were going to come back to that transformation of if that was something you were going to focus on more.
I could. I mean, you got sort of a 10-minute version of something that took 23 years to happen.
Right.
So I mean, I could talk more about the evolution in my own thinking and awareness and so on.
Just my own personal opinion, but I think that would lend to, you know, it wouldn't just be like, this is what my students learned and this is how they changed, but like your own kind of transformation as well.
That's the next research project. You get 1 year release time to